how the message got around so quickly without cell phones or anything like that. But as soon as that route was decided, things started to go really bad. And the parsonage that we lived in next door started to get rocks thrown at it. In this neighborhood, which we had a lot of kids on our block, and there was a woman, Mrs. Novak. You know, we all went, it was the end of the baby boom, we all went from house to house, and that was sort of, you could tell whose parents really liked having kids and whose didn't. And Mrs. Novak, she had one kid, she really liked having kids over. She always had cookies, and she was like Laura Petrie. She was always in capris and blonde hair, and Noelle had a canopy pink and white bed, and we liked hanging out there. She was always really nice to the kids. So my mother, as soon as things started to get violent, said, I got to get the kids out of the house, and she called this neighbor across the street who she sort of trusted. And said, I got to bring the kids. And I knew something was really bad. At this point, I'm like 8. When my mother, who was a glam girl, who never went out of the house without makeup and high heels, went out in her curlers and bare feet to deliver the kids across the street. That was actually one of the most distressing details when I look back to me. It was just so off, you know? And so we went across. And I sort of think of it in slow motion because Mrs. Novak was out there and her face was contorted and she was yelling at us and she was cursing even the kids. And she had, and these teen boys who kind of protected the little kids on the block were out there with German shepherds. And everything had switched very completely. All these people I knew to be very good people had turned completely. And all my father had done was say, we are open, the doors of the church are open to anybody. They didn't make it to the church, which was good. My dad says there would not have been a stained glass window left intact if they had. But the other thing was the response from the congregation who didn't like the opening of the doors and who didn't come back to church. And that sort of did in us in that neighborhood. So I think about that. They hadn't liked the 1963 trip to the South either. However, a few weeks after that, President Kennedy was assassinated, and people had to come back to church because they needed to pray someplace. And I have seen this movement before. So I've been thinking about marching. A lot of us are going to march next week in various venues. I know Susan Becker and I are going to Washington, and I hesitated to bring it up because it would be, I believe in complete separation of church and state, and it's disingenuous to suggest that this doesn't have any political overtones, this marching. However, I've been thinking about what marching is about, and it's about showing visibility when people feel invisible. It's about saying, we're here. Now, I don't know what I have, and I try and think, what is the part of the church in this? What is the part of the church when things seem like they have changed really suddenly, when people that you think you knew look completely different to you? And I spent New Year's Day in my church in Tucson, which was more radicalized church than this. They were a sanctuary church. There's Presbyterian, but sanctuary church. But they're grappling with this, too. And I think churches across the nation must be grappling. How do we discuss things? What do we do here? And I, in D.C., Sojourners magazine has said, hey, we're opening our offices before the march. Come pray with us if you want. And the Quaker Church has said, we are a warming center for you if you want. So people are opening the doors to the church. And I think that's about one of the things we can do that's not political, that say, this is, the church is open to all. And as a coda to this, a couple years ago, I was at the Southern Food Writers Conference, which is the best conference to go to. and it was about Southern food and civil rights movement in Jackson, Mississippi. So I really was interested in going to it. And I was sitting there at the hotel talking to somebody about Ed King and wondering if he's still alive. And they said, yeah, he's still alive. You know, I said, well, I'd like to find him. I should mention, too, that while they were in jail, he came and delivered communion to all the northern ministers in jail. And they said, well, you know, he's probably down at church. It was a Sunday morning. He's probably down at the Methodist church. It's about a mile away. So I walked down there, and the first person I ran into, I said, it's an integrated church now. And the first person I ran into said, I said, do you know where Ed King is? He said, right there. And so I went and I introduced myself to him, and we talked a little bit about those days. And he said, well, I have to go now. I have to set up communion for everybody. And I thought that was like, you can be radical and still setting up communion, still doing your church duties, still doing everything. You can be working for change and still doing that. So, thanks. Patty?
Good morning. Could I have the picture up, Valerie? I can't talk. I know you want me to start talking, but I can't talk until I have the picture. And so, if we can't get the picture, I will talk. But. So, well, let me preface this by saying that when Gail was up here talking about the Esther Project and saying that, you know, when you're a white person and feel like you're colorblind, that's not the experience from the other side. And so I got to thinking about that. So this is my family, and I don't know how well you can see him. On the very far end, on the right side, is my younger brother and his wife, Ann Yanagi, who is Japanese-American. And then I'm next to Ann. Next to me is my niece, Michelle, and my nephew-in-law, Will Howard, who is African-American. Next to them is my nephew, Matthew, and his life partner, Manisha, who is Indian-American, not Native American, Indian-American. Next to them, my older brother and his wife Patty, my older brother Randy and his wife Patty. Next to them, my niece Megan and her husband Gabby, who is a Palestinian Christian from northern Israel, a little town called Elbun. And then various kids, and then my father on the couch, who is no longer with us. So I got to thinking about my family, which is very diverse. And, you know, I thought, well, I've never seen them as anything different, but maybe I need to talk to them about their experience in this white, crazy family. So I'm just going to share with two, because I'd like to talk about Gabby at another time, his experience as a Palestinian in Israel. So I wanted to talk about my sister-in-law, Anne, who is Japanese-American. And so she is from a Buddhist background, so I had to explain to her Esther, the Book of Esther, and the story. And then I asked her about, has it been hard to be in this, basically I said, has it been hard to be in this crazy white family? Because we are kind of a crazy white family. And she said the only thing that was really, she said, I've never felt like anybody treated me differently. But she said, you know, your parents, my parents who were very conservative Republicans, she said it was very difficult. Anne's parents were both in internment camps in World War II. And so her view, she goes into schools and shares this. So the tone of the latest election and people talking about building walls and things, she said, you know, that's really scary. And she said, words are important. You know, it's not just rhetoric. Words are important. And then I talked to Will, who's African-American. He grew up in Michigan, although later in life moved to the South, which was quite a different place. He said that the first thing he remembered about somebody treating him differently is he was 16 and he was working at McDonald's and he was walking to work, and he passed this yard where this little kid was, 3 to 4 years old, who started yelling at him, saying, "Get out of here, use the N-word." And Will's like, you know, he'd not encountered that before. And his response, which has been his response now his whole life, is, these people are ignorant. They just don't know. They just don't understand. Will is a policeman in Loveland, Colorado. I asked him, well, you obviously must run into, you know, people making comments. Well, I can tell you Will's very large, and he's very imposing in his uniform. But he says people do occasionally make comments. And he just says, well, they're ignorant. And it just kind of rolls off of him, which I think is kind of amazing. And when I asked him about, you know, being in this crazy white family, and he said, you know, nobody's ever treated me as anything but Will. And I hope to someday talk to you about Manisha and Gabby, but I'll leave it for there, and I think Joyce is up next.
So mine is a happy story. It's really about both Martin Luther King and Esther, and it's about Esther's because she asked people to fast and pray for her that she would be able to come before the king. And I've experienced a lot of people praying for me in this story, and I'm very appreciative, and that's one of the things that we really need to do. Actually, it starts in the summer of 1968 when Martin Luther King was assassinated. I lived in Chicago. I worked for the summer in an Upward Bound program for kids that are failing but are college material. On staff that summer, we had a black organizer, a black revolutionary, a white artist, and me. And I was tutoring those children, the young people in Latin American history. At first, they wouldn't come to my class because I was white. Oh, we also had a black administrator, but he wasn't teaching. We were the staff people. And so, but the summer also included a week at Lake Geneva where we were the kids 24/7. And at the end of the whole program, which was maybe 6 or 8 weeks, we all sat around a table and held hands, and we talked about our experience. And they said to me, you're black. And I said, thank you for the compliment, but I have not had to navigate the system because of the color of my skin. I would find out about that later for actually around 25 years. But I had been married 3 years. The next year, 1969, my daughter was born. And on December 31st, 1970, we adopted my son, who is biracial. His name is Andy. And this is a lot about Andy. At that time, biracial boys were the most difficult to place for adoption, and they might spend their whole lives in the foster care system. As I heard even this week, a young man who spent his whole life in the foster care system. I don't know whether he was white or black because I heard him on the radio. When we got Andy, he was ill. 9 months after we got him, we were evicted from our house, our apartment where we had lived for a couple years. When we went to go to another place, we asked the landlady, is this okay if we have this biracial son? Oh, sure, it's okay with me, but don't tell anybody else. So then in 1974, my husband had an affair and moved out. In 1975, I came here with the children who were by then 5 and 6 to go to graduate school. I had them sent to King School on the bus, and later my daughter said, Mom, I always take my children to school because we rode the bus and people teased me and Andy. They said he was my boyfriend. I said, no, he's my brother. Fast forward then to sixth grade, and Andy is having a hard time. He's taller than I am. He's decided that he should have adult privileges. He's tall. So then we had the youth detention center, we had the county jail, off and on, we had living on the streets, we had two group homes. It was difficult. After one group home, he came back and we made a contract of what he and I would do. He was in high school. He got a job, he worked at a grocery store, but there were problems getting paid. He did a good job, they liked him, but he wouldn't let me help. Later he told me, Mom, you can get drugs on any corner of the block we live in. There was alcohol, there was life on the streets. Eventually there was 9.5 years in the federal penitentiary system. There was visiting prisons. There's a whole indignity of prisons, of rules always changing. Sometimes to go to visit, you don't have the right thing. You have to go back and buy something and so you can come back and visit. There was his journey in prison. Would he fight to defend himself? How would that go? What would he decide? Eventually, he decided that maybe some of the values he'd grown up with would be helpful for him. So he got out of prison. But I neglected to say before he went to prison, he had decided that dropping out of school was better. Education wasn't making me rich. Here I was educated. Drugs were a lot better, so he had people selling drugs for him, made quite a lot of money. When I asked him about it, he said, Mom, I didn't steal it. He met Becky, and they had two children together, totally planned, Jasmine and Devin. Jasmine's now 21, and Devin is 19. Jasmine is a junior in college, and Devin is a sophomore. But then he got out of prison. He actually came to New Covenant with me for about 3 months until he got his feet wet again. And then became the journey of, well, I want to have what I didn't have. And so he worked really, really hard. He got a lot of credit card debt. He got in a fight. He was back then in jail for 6 months and 30 days. And before he went there, he married Rachel, who had a son by a previous relationship. But when he got out, here he was. Now he needed to get his driver's license again. But somehow they lost his records. They lost his records a lot of times, notwithstanding a lot of money. When he got out of jail, some policeman that he had known in Champaign said, you come to Champaign, we're picking you up. You stay in Urbana. Stayed in Urbana for a long time, and then he had an opportunity to move to Champaign. He did work for his landlord. At some point, he said, I want to own my house. What would that take? Well, he had to pay off the debt that you have when you come out of prison. He had to clear up his credit card debt. Meanwhile, he and Rachel have had two children. Lola is 6 now, and Lincoln is 3. What would that take? And it'd take that he'd have to get the record that he was no longer on patrol. Would have to make sure that all his taxes were up to date. He did all those things. He's done a lot of discipline. And now, on the 30th of this month, only a few days, I almost cry, he's going to close on buying his own house. And he said, you know, Mom, I worked so hard for this. I hardly know what I will do. I think maybe, though, we'll have, like, family nights out maybe once or twice a month. We have a little more money. And I'll get Devin drum lessons, which, of course, he had drum lessons when he was younger. And I'm saying to you these things because it was 25 years where a lot of people prayed, and it made it possible for him to make this movement. And I also want to recommend to you two movies that talk something about that. And one is The Hidden Women, Another is Moonlight. And then there's a book by Ta-Nehisi Coates of letters that he's written to his son about what it's like to walk around with black skin. Cindy is next.
Okay, so I apologize, but I'm going to read because you will appreciate the fact that I stay on time. Okay, so I'm the third child of parents who were old when they married and had a family, so they came from a distinctly different era, both born in the early 1900s. My mother was a well-educated woman for a woman of her time and worked full-time all of my life as an elementary school teacher, mostly in the public school systems. My father came from semi-poverty and had a very limited education because he had to leave school to help support his family of origin, since he was one of the oldest of 11 children. So what does that have to do with Martin Luther King? Well, these two parents never talked about race, except to have my mother express her opinion that she didn't agree with interracial marriage, notwithstanding that my oldest niece is married to an African-American man. My mother died before that ever occurred. I don't know what she would have said. My father wasn't particularly philosophical at all, but seemed to accept most people at face value, regardless of ethnicity or race. My only contact with anyone of color as a child was one of the women who came to clean our house once a week. I actually didn't even really know her. I just would see her occasionally once a week. Then when I was in high school, which was a high school of like 700 students, no, there were three African-American students, two of whom I did not even know were African-American. One of them was a girl that I sang with in some elite choral group, and who was not only physically beautiful, but had the most incredible voice that I had ever heard in my entire life, and I was totally jealous of her. Only to find out, towards the end of my senior year, after I had known her for a couple of years, that her father was African-American. He never came to her concerts. I never saw him until one day they invited us to their house and I met her father for the first time. So I grew up in the 50s and 60s as a part of a white, middle-class, conservative, religious culture with a colored congregation from the same denomination being across town. I went to church camp with children from other congregations, but never the children from the black congregation. Even though I attended public school from 6th to 12th grade, I grew up very unaware and naive regarding anything to do with the history of race relations in our country, the civil rights struggle, and to be honest, Martin Luther King. I moved here to Champaign after graduating from a small Bible college I attended where the only people of color were the missionaries from other countries. Here I finally met, became a coworker, became an acquaintance, and became friends with people of color. I've spent most of my adult life trying to understand and learn what the struggles have been and continue to be for people of color, as well as what my personal place is in response to that struggle. While I have continued to learn, I don't claim to be anywhere close to truly understanding what it is like to be a person of color here in the U.S. Part of my own struggle has been knowing how I can be a part of the process of healing instead of continuing to be a part of the separation and hurt. That struggle includes trying to understand how, on one hand, some of my acquaintances and friends are more angry and militant, while others are quieter in their working to counteract the injustices of racism. I am uncomfortable with anger, in general, even as a way of making a point or overcoming injustices. I'm more inclined to work behind the scenes, so to speak, in areas of education, health, and community support for people in need. But I have learned that I don't honestly know what is best at times. So I guess what I'm saying is that for me, being part of the beloved community often means, and this is hard for me, means stepping back and listening to those who have lived an experience that I can only partially understand. It means letting go and letting those who have experienced what the hurt and the injustices dictate to me how to respond. It means not assuming I know how best to respond, what best for which to advocate, but rather to follow the lead of those who have lived it. Much of this I learned through friendships with those who, though they didn't have to trust this naive white woman, did so anyway, and shared their own life experiences with me, and answered often my very naive questions. Some of this I learned while having children in the school system, and seeing the subtle and not so subtle inequalities. I learned that advocating for my own children, while necessary and certainly good for me to do, was not enough. Rather, I needed to open my eyes and my heart to the realities of the lives of others and advocate for those children and families as well. I have learned, while at times I don't understand why some things matter to my friends of color, I can trust their decisions as I walk alongside them as my sisters and brothers.
Didn't come out, but to me, I think we have to always remember that if God calls us to something, it's not only to bless others, it's to bless us. It's when we're called to help come alongside someone, to help them, it's for our freedom too. So as we go to communion, on the tables, there are two things. One, are cards like this, multicolored cards like this, with different quotes that I've collected. Take one, take two, but don't take five. The other thing is a post-it note. What we're asking you to do is to write one step you could take in this coming week that God's calling you to, in terms of us being, bringing, us moving closer to freedom and us becoming more of the beloved community God calls us to be. What we'll do with those is, we don't want names, we'll just write those up as a resource, because I find when I listen to stories, I'm like, oh, hadn't thought of doing that. So we'll write it up for everyone else just to have ideas. It could be as simple as what Joyce said, going to a movie, right? Or it could be talking to family members that you hadn't talked to before. Or it could be advocating. There's lots of different ways. So our communion tables are God's tables. They're for everyone who wants to go there. Before we go to communion, but as a transition, we're going to show a video that was made by the youth group of 2011. And then you go to communion.
Okay. Look down from a broken sky. Traced out by the city lights, my world from a mile high. Best seat in the house tonight. Touch down in the cold black top. Hold on for the sudden stop. Breathe in the familiar shock of confusion and chaos. All those people going somewhere. Why have I never cared? Give me your eyes for just 1 second. Give me your eyes so I can see everything that I keep missing. Give me your love for humanity. Give me your arms for the brokenhearted, the ones that are far beyond my reach. Give me your heart for the ones forgotten. Give me your eyes so I can see. Yeah. 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 Step out on a busy street. See a girl and our eyes meet.
does her best to smile at me, to hide what's underneath. There's a man just to her right, black suit and a bright red tie. Too ashamed to tell his wife he's out of work, he's buying time. All those people going somewhere, why have I never cared? Give me your eyes for just one second. Give me your eyes so I can see everything that I keep missing. Give me your love for humanity. Give me your arms for the brokenhearted, the ones that are far beyond my reach. Give me your heart for the ones forgotten. Give me your eyes so I can see. Yeah. 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 I've been here a million times, a couple million eyes, just moving past me by. That's where I never thought that I was wrong. Well, I want a second glance, so give me a second chance to see the way you see the people all along. Give me your eyes for just one second. Give me your eyes so I can see everything that I keep missing. Give me your love for humanity. Give me your arms for the brokenhearted, the ones that are far beyond my reach. Give me your heart for the ones forgotten. Give me your eyes so I can see. Give me your eyes.